All right, welcome back. This is the Vegan Rainbow on WHRW. I'm Bill Houston.
And I'm Mike Hudak.
And we are listening to a little bit of Osric Tentacles. Do you like that, Mike?
Oh, yeah, it's great.
So we let that go a little longer. We normally play the music. So I think we have been informed that our guest is on the line.
Great.
Who is our guest today, Mike?
Okay, our guest today is Richard Schwartz, Ph.D. He is the author of three books, Judaism and Vegetarianism, Judaism and Global Survival, and Mathematics and Global Survival. He has over 100 articles on the Internet and frequently speaks and contributes articles on environmental, health, and other current issues. He is Professor Emeritus of Mathematics at the College of Staten Island, President of the Jewish Vegetarians of North America, and coordinator of the Society of Ethical and Religious Vegetarians. Richard, thank you for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Let's talk a little bit about your background. Your academic training has been in mathematics rather than
engineering, actually, but I got into math.
But really not in the topics that are central to your books for the most part. And I'm wondering, how did you develop these other interests in ecology and religion and diet, aside from your professional work?
Well, actually, there's a tie-in because in teaching mathematics, which I'm doing as though I'm now retired at the College of Staten Island, for a time I was teaching liberal arts non-science students. They're very weak in math, poorly prepared, poorly motivated and all. And anyway, one thing led to another. I got this brainstorm and I set up a course, which was very unique for a long time and now it's becoming more popular, something called Mathematics in the Environment. So the idea was to relate basic math ideas, graphs and statistics, probability, some mathematical models from population to environmental issues. And as I got into it, I tried to tie it in with what's happening in the world, the issues of energy and hunger, things that would come up year by year. And as I got into that, I found out that widespread hunger, and I thought maybe there's just too many people, but then I found that one of the main reasons is that we're feeding so much grain to the animals. And then I saw that becoming a vegetarian would help quite a bit in that regard. So that was one of the connections.
But you actually wrote your book about vegetarianism before you wrote the one dealing with ecology and those issues.
Well, actually, I've been giving that course, Math and the Environment, since 1974 or 5. And then I think I took a sabbatical, like in 1979, and really wrote a first edition. This math book's been around many, many editions.
Oh, really?
Because it's so centered on events of the world. You know, I just take a news article and I would take some of the numbers and convert it into a math problem. You know, what percent of the world's people live in the U.S. and in China? What's the ratio of China's population to that of the U.S. and all? And recently I've got a whole bunch of very good graphs on health and nutrition and all that. And then my first edition of Judaism and Vegetarianism actually came out in 1982, and the third edition just came out 2001, actually. And then, you know, as I taught that course and found about the many threats to the world, I thought I had to do something about it, and that's why it's Math and Global Survival. But I've always had the feeling that religion has many messages that can be very helpful. You know, and in all my books, I try to write them to be something sort of unique. There was many good books on vegetarianism, so I didn't want to just repeat that. But, you know, to try to tie it in with religion, I didn't see anything at that time like that, so I got into that.
All right. Of course, at the time you wrote that first book, there weren't all that many books. I think Keith Akers wrote his book, Vegetarian Source Book, in the early 80s. I think he said that he wrote it because there really wasn't anything else like it at the time. There were a lot of cookbooks.
No, absolutely.
But not a lot of books talking about the relationship of diet to the environment and raising of animals and so on.
Well, there weren't too many, but there were a few and all. Anyway, I just felt very strongly that here is something that you know, if you tell people you should be a vegetarian for this reason and that, they can just say, well, I don't really care that much. I'm just interested in my own enjoyment. But if you tell somebody who's religious, theoretically, and they say, you know, there's a contradiction between the realities of animal-based diets and animal-based agriculture and the principles of your religion, then they should pay more attention, you know, because they're claiming to be religious practitioners. What I'm trying to do is not, God forbid, start any new religions, but try to say, let's put our religions into practice. And as you know, all religions have teachings about compassion and sharing and justice and mercy and all that. So seem ready-made, and that's where I came up with six biblical or Torah mandates that I feel point to vegetarianism as the ideal diet for those who take religion seriously and really for everybody.
Before we get into those specific issues, let's talk a little bit about your background in Judaism. You say, I think maybe it's on your website, that you describe yourself as a returnee to Judaism. You don't have a formal training. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit about your own experiences growing up and how you educated yourself about these issues.
Well, like a lot of Jews, I did go to what they call Talmud Torah, which was like maybe a couple of afternoons, maybe an hour or so on Sunday, you know, so it was really basic. Minimum until bar mitzvah, but somehow I always had an interest, especially in part of the Talmud called the Ethics of the Fathers. There's really a lot of teachings about ethical behavior and all. And as a matter of fact, when I went to college, as many do, I went through a radical period, and I was as far from religion as can be. It was like, you know, we have to get involved in the issues, and religion isn't doing that. But I guess probably through my wife and presenting certain books, and you know, I started reading more and seeing that ideally religion and Judaism had all the teachings I really wanted, you know, and it, in terms of justice, in terms, as I said before, mercy and all that. Unfortunately, not always put into practice, and that's why I'm trying to do this, to say that the world is so threatened, and Jewish values and you know, Christian values and all. If somebody really gets down to it and says, you know, this is God's world, it's threatened so badly, we have to do something about it. So a lot of it is self-learned and all. And you may have noticed in all of my books, in the acknowledgments, I've always got a lot of people that I depend on. You know, I write the best I can and I get it out to people and, you know, just to make sure and double-check and triple-check. And so I've had some very knowledgeable people taking a look at it also. And just thank God so much is in translation. And, you know, by focusing on a few things, see, I often tell people, you know, and I mentioned that mathematics and the environment course I've been giving, and you mentioned I have that book, Math and Global Survival. By teaching that many, many years, over 20 years, it gave me some ideas of the secular part that I needed for my books. You know, what the issues are on hunger and energy shortages and pollution, etc. And then, as I said, I've been doing a lot of reading of Judaism, so I feel there's people that know more about the global and environmental issues than me, people that know more about Judaism, but usually it's one or the other. So I was lucky to have like a synthesis, to have a little bit of both. Plus, as I said, using the great wisdom out there, and you know, I have a fair amount of quotes because I want to build it on something. I'm not starting a new religion. I'm saying religious teachings are there. Let's put them into practice.
Let's talk about some of the issues that you raise in your book, Judaism and Global Survival. You devote entire chapters to topics such as human rights. Can you give us a little bit of a description of how that fits into Judaism?
Okay, well, Judaism teaches that every person is created in God's image, and there's even a lesson from the fact that one person, Adam, was created, and one of the lessons is that we're all really descended from that one person, so nobody can say my ancestors are better than your ancestors. There's a lot of teachings like that, and because each person, every single person in this world, is considered to be created in God's image, therefore every life is sacred. You know, every life is important. And a lot of teachings like that. And there's one thing, of course, justice is very much related to this as well. And as one rabbi pointed out, the Bible has a special kind of justice in a way. You know, people often think of justice like I own this, and if someone wants to buy it, there's a fair price, and that's just, and, you know, I get my price, he gets it, he's good. But in Judaism and in religion in general, something called empathic justice, which is the justice which takes into account the other person, and that's related to the fact, which is coming up in the holiday of Passover, which is just actually starting exactly 2 weeks from tonight, that, you know, we were slaves in Egypt, and one of the teachings was that we should know the heart of the stranger since we were slaves in the land of Egypt. And so important is that teaching that it actually occurs more than any other verse in one form or another. 36 times the idea of being kind to the stranger, considering the life of the stranger. So again, there's a lot of teachings of that type, that each life is important, and we have to consider that very carefully.
And then you also talk about matters of ecology. And then you talk about some specific environmental problems in Israel, which I found quite fascinating.
Okay, in terms of ecology, of course, there's a very important teaching in the book of Psalms that says the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. But people are to be co-workers and partners with God in protecting that world. And very much related to that is a teaching in Deuteronomy, actually chapter 20, verses 19 and 20, that talks about, in the time of warfare even, that we're not to destroy fruit-bearing trees to build a battering ram to try to overcome an enemy fortification. And what the rabbinic sages did, they took that one very special case of a battering ram, wartime, not destroying trees, and they generalized that into a very broad principle, which if put into practice would really revolutionize the world, because it's called Baal Tashchit in Hebrew, and it really states, thou shalt not waste to destroy anything of value. So they went beyond not just trees, but anything. Not just wartime, because if you can't destroy in wartime, it should even more so in a time of peace. Mm-hmm. And not just the idea of taking an axe to destroy the trees, but not to destroy it in any way, whether it be diverting a stream and all that. That's a general, very important principle that the earth is the Lord's. He has provided us with an abundance of resources. Of course, we have to build them. We can't say we'll never cut down a tree or anything, but we have to minimize the waste. As you know, society, I believe, is based on buying, using, disposing, wasting, and I'm talking to you now from Staten Island, which was the capital, unfortunately, of garbage disposal, because we had the world's largest garbage dump for many, many years, and now they're talking about converting it into a park and all kinds of great recreational. Now, in terms of Israel, unfortunately, like so many other countries, as you point out, there's a wide variety of environmental problems. The rivers are very polluted. The air is polluted. You know, it's a relatively small country, industrialized, many, many positive things being done. And also, you know, the security issue has diverted attention from the environmental issues. But this is a very serious problem. And so there are some serious environmental problems there and in other places. So what I'm trying to do is state that we have these teachings on the environment, that it's God's will, but we have to be partners, co-workers, and all that, and we can't destroy fruit-bearing trees, and we can't destroy anything. You know, we keep wasting, and of course, this is related to the more general problems, global climate change, which I think is the biggest threat to humanity in the coming decades, and species are disappearing perhaps faster than ever before, at least since the time of the dinosaurs. They're predicting at least half the world's people may live in areas short of water by the middle of the century, destroying tropical rainforests. It's hard to see what to be concerned about first, but luckily we have the teachings, but in writing my books, I'm trying to, you know, sort of awaken people up to the need to apply these, because we're already seeing very negative effects of global climate change. And the climate experts are predicting far higher temperature increases in the coming decade.
You've also tied the environmental degradation to issues of social and political tension. So I'm wondering then, what can you say about the message of your book as it regards prospects for future terrorism?
Well, you know, some people have pointed out global warming may kill more people than all the terrorism put together. So, I mean, that's one factor. Also, you know, I don't pretend to be a super expert on this. We know it's a complex problem, but I believe that, you know, the thing I've been writing about vegetarianism, for example, that where there's hunger in the world, there's more chance for violence. Mm-hmm. Where there's pollution and people are forced to move out of areas because it's so polluted or there's not enough water. So, as I say, it's certainly complex, and many things have to be done. But I would hope that applying these religious values in a positive sense, you know, we know, unfortunately, throughout history, people have often applies in very negatively, like you have a different religion, well, either you convert or you'll face the sword and all that. But we do have these very positive messages. If we apply these values in terms of even biblical values, like farmers are to leave the corners of the field, gleanings of the harvest to the poor, sort of a decentralized system, so that it's not just a matter of saying, here it is, I'm just giving it to you people. Poor people had to go out. They were left with the corners of the field, gleanings of the harvest. So it was really a great welfare system where people had to have a part in it, for example. So if we apply these values and try to reduce global warming, which I said could be something that really kills far more people if there's flooding in major areas. And already, by the way, I think it was 35,000 Europeans died last summer as the temperatures in Europe, you may recall, reached 120 degrees Fahrenheit in places where they had very little air conditioning because normally you don't need it and seldom got beyond the 70s. So that is a threat. And so I would hope that if there was greater sharing, and vegetarianism is part of it because it requires far less land and far less grain that's eventually fed to animals and far less water, so that if conditions are better for people, again, it's not the whole answer, but I think it would be a part of it, and especially if the world looked, say, at the U.S. as being a country that is promoting an end to disease and poverty and hunger and promoting a better sharing of the world's resources and promoting policies that would reduce the threats of global warming and biodiversity losses and water shortages, I would hope that an improved image would help. Again, there's always some that no matter what you do, it's going to be negative and going to be some terrorism, but these are some of the approaches that might help reduce it.
Let's move on then to your book on vegetarianism. You've argued that a switch toward vegetarianism is not only an important individual choice, but that it is also a religious imperative and a societal imperative. Can you explain why?
This is the fundamental question, I believe. And the reason I say it's a religious imperative is that there's at least six fundamental religious mandates that are very severely violated by animal-based diets. And most of what I do, of course, is Judaism-based, but other religions also tie in with the same point. Anyway, the six mandates that are violated are, first, that we must be very diligent in taking care of our health. We must treat animals with compassion. We must be co-workers with God in protecting the environment. And we must conserve natural resources. We must help and share with hungry people, and we must work for a nonviolent society in seeking and pursuing peace. And, you know, I'd be happy to expand on all of these in a way, because just going very quickly through it, there's no doubt that animal-based diets are very harmful to our health. I mean, the way animals are treated today, 50 billion farmed animals worldwide raised on factory farms for the most part and in very cruel conditions. And because it's 50 billion animals we're talking about, it has very negative effects on the environment. You need far more grain, you need far more water, and all, which violates this idea that we ought to conserve resources. And in terms of helping hungry people, it says an estimated 20 million people are dying of hunger and its effects every single year, and yet in the U.S. alone, we're feeding 70% of the grain to animals destined for slaughter. And as some have pointed out, it can take up to 16 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of edible beef. So that's why I think that it's a religious mandate. And in terms of being a societal imperative, there too, because of the 50 billion animals that we're trying to raise, it's having very negative effects on the environment. And the number one issue, I think, that threatens humanity today is that global climate change. And here, too, there are connections, because to save a nickel in a fast food hamburger, we are destroying and often burning down tropical rainforests, and that is destroying trees, which take in carbon dioxide, the number one greenhouse gas. So we're destroying that, and when we burn the trees, we're giving off carbon dioxide. It's like a double negative. Then in addition, all the cattle raised there on the pasture land created by destroying the trees are giving off methane, the nitrous oxide from nitrogen fertilizer. Also, all of these are greenhouse gases. And you need, as I said, far more water. You need, you're using a lot more pesticides. So it's like insanity at a time when the water is facing severe water shortages, when the tropical rainforests are disappearing, along with more than half the species of the planet residing in these tropical rainforests, having a diet that is so unhealthy is just like madness and sheer insanity.
You point out in your book, Judaism and Vegetarianism, that environmental degradation can increase social and political tension. How can adoption of a vegetarian diet act to lessen this tension?
First of all, many people are going to die far more than even terrorism from the environmental degradation, from global warming, which could cause the increase of the elevation of our seas and all, and overcome many coasts and things of that sort. In addition, I think that, for example, if the U.S. was looked on as a nation that was committed to reducing disease worldwide and reducing poverty and homelessness, etc., that could reduce tension and, you know, get people to see there's always going to be, unfortunately, terrorism to a certain extent. There's always people, no matter what, are going to be negative. But I think if we're looked on as a nation very positive in all of these regards, that could reduce threats of terrorism and violence in the future.
In your book, you deal with the question of God giving people dominion over animals, as stated in the first chapter of Genesis. Would you give us your interpretation of the dominion issue?
Actually, the Jewish sages interpreted dominion really as responsible stewardship. It wasn't like you have dominion, therefore it's not domination, do whatever you want and all. You're the top of the world, in effect. And part of the proof of that is a couple of verses after we're given dominion, we're given the first dietary regimen. It's in chapter 1, verse 29 of Genesis, God's first dietary law, strictly vegetarian. And a couple of verses beyond that, God, after being able to claim that things were good for various parts of the creation, says it's tov me'od, or very good. So everything's in harmony, everything's part of God's creation. And then in chapter 2, verse 15, the human role in the world is given. We are to work the land, but also to guard the land. We have to be the guardians of the earth, in effect. So taken in the right way, this idea of dominion can be a very powerful argument for responsible stewardship and preserving animals rather than just exploiting them. And by the way, in Genesis, that same first chapter, there's another verse that is often misused, and that is that people, and only people, are created in God's image. But there, too, that can be very positive, because if we're created in God's image, what that should mean is that we should imitate God's attributes of mercy and justice, compassion, and all. Because it says in the book of Psalms that God's mercies are over all of his creatures, for example, and many, even many more verses like that. So if taken properly, and I have an article arguing this, the idea of dominion, the idea of people being created in God's image, have been used by animal rights advocates to negate religion, which I think is negative, you know, rather than challenging religion, which I think should be done to live up to its highest ideals. And unfortunately, these verses have been used by religious people, sometimes misused, to say, well, because of this, we can eat meat and we can treat animals any way we want. So the proper interpretation could really lead to a far better world with much greater environmental sustainability.
In your book, you discuss whether Jews must eat meat to honor the Sabbath and to celebrate Jewish holidays. Perhaps you can speak about that issue in general.
Well, there too, fortunately, there's no requirement for Jews to eat meat at any time today. Perhaps in the days of the temple, years ago it was, but after the destruction of the temple, it says that people don't have to rejoice through eating of meat. Again, it was something very special in ancient days. It wasn't like we have it today every single day. Some people have it two or three times a day. So maybe they thought, as a special symbol of celebration at a time where we didn't know that people should eat meat. But now that we know this, there's really no need for it. And in Talmud, it happens to be in the book of Pesachim 109a, it indicates that it's no longer necessary to rejoice through eating meat. People can do it through wine. And I often think, how can a person really rejoice through eating meat if, it's a bigger if, they're aware of how animals are treated, how the health is negatively affected, how the environment is being so threatened, how people are dying of hunger while we're feeding grains to animals destined for slaughter, for example. And another proof of this, a very strong proof, is that there are chief rabbis today and in previous generations who are strict vegetarians. a former chief rabbi of all of Israel, named Rabbi Shlomo Gorin, was a strict vegetarian. And today the chief rabbi of Haifa, for example, is a strict vegetarian, and there are others in other places. So if a chief rabbi, who certainly knows a lot more about Judaism than I do and is as observant as can be, can be a vegetarian, then it's certainly not necessary. And the way I put it often, by the way, is that there's a choice out there. I wish I could say that Judaism forbids eating of meat, but it doesn't work that way. God has given us certain choices, and hopes will come to the realization that we shouldn't, and argue in other places that God prefers, doesn't demand it, because he wants, again, to have free will. He didn't create us as angels, but he prefers that we eat a vegetarian or plant-based diet, because I argued God, of course, has given us good health and good potential, would like us to remain healthy. Certainly, he would like us animals not to be mistreated. He created a beautiful world, doesn't want it to be despoiled. He gave us sufficient resources. We have to use those resources, of course, but not to use it wastefully. And God is concerned about every single person, we say, created in God's image. And therefore, it's like a scandal that when God really has provided enough food, there is such widespread hunger. So today, again, there's no need. There is a choice. And what I'm arguing is that that choice, though, should not be based on just convenience or the fact that previous generations ate meat. It should be based on the highest of Jewish values. And these six mandates that I pointed out before that are violated by animal-based diets, and these are the mandates, again, to protect our health, to treat animals properly, compassionately, to be co-workers with God and preserve the environment, to conserve resources, to help the hungry, and to seek and pursue peace. And some people say, well, you know, with all that's going on in this world, how can you say it will make a difference in terms of peace? And I have two answers to that. One is sort of a pun, and it goes like this, that the slogan of the peace movement and the slogan of the vegetarian movement, these are one and the same. A song by John Lennon, "All we are saying is give peas a chance." You know, so that is a connection, but there's an even stronger connection somewhat related to that, which is that our sages saw that the Hebrew words for bread, which is lechem, and war, milchama, they come from the same root for the words for bread and for war. And from that they deduced when there's a shortage of grain and other resources, people are more likely to go to war. And we see it in today's history with the previous war in the Gulf, and today in terms of energy shortages. And in biblical times, there were battles at the wells over water. So we have these connections. No need to eat meat today. There is a choice. But I would hope that Jews who are to be Rachmanim b'nei Rachmanim, it's compassionate children of compassionate ancestors, and others in religions that are really all based on compassion, will realize they have the choice. Nobody can say you're forbidden to eat meat, but that really, if they take their religious values seriously, should at minimum seriously consider switching at least toward a plant-centered diet.
Let's consider a particular Jewish celebration in relation to vegetarianism. How do you see vegetarianism fitting into the celebratory tradition of Passover?
Once again, just to mention that there's no obligation to eat meat on Passover or any other time. You know, we're commemorating different things and all that, and some have a shank bone on the table as a commemoration of sacrifices that occurred at that time, but Jews have substitutes for that, like some use a red beet and some use a mushroom with a fleshy appearance. Okay, so there's no need to eat meat. And by the way, I have on my website, which I can give very briefly, it's relatively easy, it's one word, Jewish, followed by VEG, jewishveg.com/, to my last name, Schwartz, S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z, and I have articles there relating every single holiday to vegetarianism. And specifically on Passover, some of the lessons are that just as we were slaves, and the Passover celebrates the freedom of the Jewish people from the Egyptian bondage many, many centuries ago, you know, not quite 100% analogy, but today animals are raised under, you know, very cruel, cruel conditions, so we can certainly move away from that. And a couple of things related to the Passover Seder, they have something they call Ma'os Ki Team, which is really raising funds so that people who are needy will have enough to get sufficient things to have their own seder and all, to have enough food at the seder table. And also one of the things said early in the seder is let all who are hungry come and join us and all. So, you know, there's concern for the hungry. And as we've mentioned, animal-based diets are very wasteful of grain and water and other resources that can be used to grow enough food. So if we want to really have a diet that minimizes hunger, and by the way, I always try to point out that vegetarianism is not a complete answer. We know, unfortunately, there's political aspects, and in the past, in the U.S. Depression in the 30s, they even burned food in order to keep up prices and things like that. So more has to be done, but at least a shift toward a vegetarian diet would free up resources and have the potential of helping hungry people. So these are some of the lessons. It's also a holiday of springtime, rejuvenation, which relates to nature, and there too, vegetarian, plant-based diets are far, far more benign to the environment. Animal-based diets are having really devastating effects on the environment with overgrazing, erosion and depletion of soil, loss of biodiversity, which some experts say is occurring faster than perhaps any other time in history, at least since the time of the dinosaurs, at least. So these are lessons that we can get. And as I say, I try to do this with every single holiday, and I have that at that website, jewishveg.com/schwartz, for those who want more information about connecting all the Jewish holidays. And I'm also working with Christians and others, by the way, because everything we're saying here can easily be adapted to other religions as well.
In your book, you talk about some well-known Jewish vegetarians. Perhaps you could just tell us about a few of those.
Perhaps one of the most famous, relatively modern, is Isaac Bashevis Singer, who passed away probably in the last decade. And he, of course, a famous Yiddish writer who won the Nobel Prize for Literature. And he was a very strong vegetarian, and much about vegetarianism in many of his books. And when people used to ask him if he was a vegetarian for health reasons, he used to answer, yes, for the health of the chicken. So he was very concerned about animals and mistreatment of animals, and he felt that this, people had a protest about the injustice in the world, and this was his protest, and he felt it was a strong one. It was certainly consistent with Jewish values. Then there's S.Y. Agnon, A.G.N.O.N., who also was a Nobel Prize winner in literature. And it turns out many of the Yiddish writers years ago were vegetarian. And then we have some very important rabbis. We mentioned there were chief rabbis, like the late Rabbi Shlomo Goren. There was Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cohen Cook, who, according to reports, was not a complete vegetarian. He felt that vegetarians would come in the ideal time to come in the Messianic period, but he was a very strong supporter of vegetarianism. And he actually died in 1935, before the full advent of factory farming and all the negative things we're finding today. So I think today he might well be a vegetarian, but he certainly, as the chief rabbi, first chief rabbi of pre-state Israel and one of the great philosophers of the 20th century, is really the person who was very strong and felt that Jews should eventually become vegetarians.
I guess we're about out of time here, and we're going to have to wrap it up. Mm-hmm. So, appreciate you talking with us.
Thanks a lot.
You're quite welcome.
And this has been another edition of the Vegan Rainbow. And tune in next week at the same time. So, we'll see you then.